Hello, I am Liz Mosley and welcome back to CBI at 10. It's a pleasure to be back here and there's a lot to talk about today. So I'm grateful to our panelists for joining us to try and make sense of the current status of the economy here in this country and what we've learned from various pieces of research and forecasting that have been done about what's going to happen next. To kick us off, I'm going to go first to Alpesh Palaja, and who is lead economist at CBI. And you've just written the latest economic forecast for the CBI. But before we get into the detail of the forecast, Alpesh, could you just give us a sense of the context? I mean, we've all had fun and games trying to get to work yesterday, but what else is going on out there?
So I think there are three key issues for businesses to be aware of this week. So as you mentioned, firstly, we, of course, have the rail strikes, which occurred yesterday and are happening tomorrow and Saturday. Last minute talks to avert strike action failed, and that's particularly regrettable. That strikes are going ahead at a time when the economy is under such strain and at a time when the railway industry is seeking to bounce back from 2 years of disruption and heavy reliance on government subsidy. It looks like both passenger and freight services will be seriously impacted. Workplaces relying on the rail network will have to demonstrate even greater flexibility, and delays to delivery of critical raw materials will inevitably add to existing supply chain challenges. It's worth thinking about the implications of this over the longer term. I mean, over the long term, a robust, economical and efficient railway is an essential component of a decarbonized transport network. And damaging industrial action now could delay the much needed shift that needs to occur away from high polluting vehicles onto the railway, thus undermining confidence and investment in the sector. So that's the first issue. The second is the by-elections taking place this week, tomorrow, in fact, in Wakefield and Tiverton and Honiton. While not a strictly business critical issue, I'm sure that many will be watching this week's election results with interest. Following the confidence vote a couple of weeks ago and ongoing media speculation on the Conservative leadership, the CBI has made several interventions calling on the government to stop Operation Save Big Dog and instead focus on economic action stations, particularly in light of a weaker economic outlook ahead, which I'll come on to talk about. We recently published a list of actions the government can take now to boost confidence. And thirdly, just a quick plug for the CBI's Future of Work conference, which is taking place on the 13th of September. We know that the world of work has changed. The pandemic has shifted expectations of how, where and when we work. 1 million people have left the workforce during the pandemic, and the UK is facing really tough labour shortages with no quick fix in sight. So our conference sort of will provide insights into how businesses can navigate this new landscape. It's now open for registration, so you can find out more on our website. So to summarise, obviously, rail strikes and by-elections this week and our Future of Work conference in September will provide more insights on the other timely issue of labour shortages.
Thanks so much, Alpesh. It does feel like there's a really packed agenda if you were sitting there in number 10 thinking, how do I tackle these things in what order? And your economic forecast that was published, was it published just yesterday? It's hot off the press, I think, is no different. Now, Ray Newton-Smith, who's the chief economist of the CBI and sometimes joins us for these conversations on CBI at 10, her quote says, "This is a tough set of statistics to stomach." Easy for me to say. I just wonder if you could give us the headlines. Really, it's about a revised down in your growth forecast, isn't it?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, we have revised down our outlook for growth and we do expect a much weaker economic outlook further ahead. Sort of before we go into the forecast, it's worth very briefly just taking stock of where we are on the economy right now. Data does seem to be pointing to a sharp slowdown in activity over the coming months. We've seen big falls in consumer and business confidence, and for consumer confidence in particular, we've seen the largest fall on record. Business surveys, including the CBI's own surveys, are pointing to softer growth in activity. And in particular, consumer-facing sectors are suffering, particularly sort of consumer services like hotels, bars and restaurants. And while the labour market is very tight, we are starting to see signs, very early signs of a softening. You know, we did see a notable pickup in the unemployment rate over March. All of that does broadly chime with our economic forecast, in which we do expect weaker growth over the year ahead. The main driver of that is high inflation. We've just had data out just this morning showing that CPI inflation rose above 9% in May, staying at the 40-year high that we saw in April. Obviously, inflation has been rising for global reasons. It's very much a global problem. Pressures in global supply chains combined with rising demand as economies lifted COVID restrictions have pushed up commodity prices. That's been exacerbated by the war in Ukraine. But also, you know, there are signs that higher inflation is becoming more widespread within the CBI basket, sort of moving to more domestically focused bits of the basket itself. The upshot is we expect inflation to remain high this year. It doesn't fall much below 8%, and in particular peaks again in October when Ofgem is widely expected to raise the energy price cap again. That strength in inflation bites quite hard for households, and it means that we expect to see the biggest fall in households' real incomes this year since records began in the mid-1950s. And we do expect household spending alone to enter a technical recession. It falls persistently for the next year. And while everyone will see a squeeze in their living standards, it's worth noting that it's the poorest households who will be hit the hardest because they spend more of their income on staples like food and utility bills, but have already seen sort of a hit to their finances from the pandemic. Falling household spending is the main driver of the weakness in economic growth over our forecast. And in particular, sort of when we go into next year, growth pretty much just slows to a crawl. We don't expect the economy as a whole to fall into a technical recession. But this will very much feel like a recession to many households. And as I said earlier, businesses will be facing a weaker trading environment. One of the key things preventing the economy from falling into the red is business investment. We actually do expect some growth in investment until early next year. And a crucial support to that is coming from the government's super deduction. But this story actually changes in the spring of next year once the super deduction expires. It's scheduled to expire in April 2023. And after that, business investment falls back and actually ends our forecast still 7% below its level prior to the pandemic. And alongside that, a key theme in our forecast, alongside sort of this weakness in household spending and the reversal in business investment, is just how weak the other underpins to growth are. You know, we don't really see a recovery in exports. You know, they pick up a bit, but they're still 10% below their pre-COVID level at the end of next year. And that stands in quite stark contrast to other advanced economies where exports either recover or have already exceeded this benchmark. Again, productivity remains quite sluggish. It only gets back to its underwhelming pre-COVID trend. And that now marks over a decade where productivity in the UK has been effectively stagnant. And that's a huge drag on the UK's living standards and our economy's capacity to grow over the longer term. So all of that really underscores the need for concerted action to address this sort of structural weakness in the UK economy. You know, the government really needs to make a full commitment to a permanent successor to the super deduction, particularly given the key role that business investment is playing in the near term in supporting the economy. You know, given the tightness in the labour market, you know, it's time to really get real on concerns over labour shortages. You know, things like sort of drafting a new shortage occupation list, adding on sectors with obvious labour shortages like aviation, and introducing flexibility to the apprenticeship levy so that employers can kind of use the levy funds to tackle labour shortages. You know, these are among just a few actions that need to take place to sort of restore confidence in the outlook and really shore up both near and longer term growth. So that's a very whirlwind summary. As I say, it's not looking good further ahead. The cost of living crisis is very much set to persist, at least over the coming year. There are a few things that keep us out of recession, and business investment is notably one of them. But that's very much a temporary support. And with other growth underpins looking weak, government really needs to do more to boost productivity and confidence.
Alpesh, it's fascinating hearing the sort of package of challenges and of pressures. I've just noticed Emma Swan has asked a question where can we find the economic forecast? I'm sure that Alice will post one in the chat. I know it is published on the CBI website if you want to sort of dive into the detail of some of these things. I'd love to come back to you as well, Alpesh, to talk about some of the other sort of package of recommendations. Just before I do, just in case people watching or listening don't know what the super deduction is, because I know the CBI has been calling for an extension or a successor to that policy for a while. Just briefly give us a sense of what that facility does and what would replace it if and when it comes to an end when it's scheduled to?
Sure. So the super deduction is essentially a tax incentive for companies to invest. It allows them to claim back sort of 150% of the tax that they otherwise would have paid on the investment itself. And that was very specifically designed to not only incentivize new investment, but for companies to sort of bring forward investment that they had sort of planned further ahead. Obviously, you know, we have survey data that suggests that has been a big underpin in supporting capital spending at a time when, you know, the recovery from COVID was looking a bit shaky. That's not only important for the near term, but it's also important for the longer term, because growing the capital stock, you know, boosts the economy's potential to grow over the longer term. And we've called for a permanent successor to the super deduction. So not necessarily one that's as generous as it is at the moment, but one that kind of allows companies to claim back 100% of the tax on capital spending, but also widening the definition. So it includes more assets. And so there are more sort of eligible assets for investment in that regard, and you know that there is a good structural case for that. You know, the UK doesn't do very well on investment allowances compared to other countries, so this would only be helping us to sort of narrow the gap with other G7 economies where business investment is a lot stronger.
Thanks ever so much. That's really helpful. While we're talking about investment, this is a good moment to bring in Peter Arnold, who's joined us this morning, Chief Economist of EY. The CBI's recommendations, business investment is this critical lever to sort of try and balance out some of the headwinds that are hitting us, over which we have little control because many of them are global factors. And EY, you've just published your annual survey, haven't you, about specifically the UK attractiveness survey. Just talk us through how investors are feeling about the UK as a place to invest and do business right now.
So, Liz, as you mentioned, we do an annual survey of FDI, so foreign direct investment into UK, and indeed it's a European-wide survey. So we look at the volume of FDI investments, but also the drivers of that investment. I mean, actually, the UK does pretty well when you look at its performance across Europe. So unsurprisingly, inward investment fell quite dramatically in 2020 by about 13% across Europe, 12% in the UK. And it's bounced back a little bit in 2021, so investment up by about 5%. UK did a little bit, lagged Europe a little bit, so only by about 2%. But when you look at measures of sentiment, and when we ask investors where they see the most attractive locations for inward investment, UK was second to France this year, and London comes out as the number one city across Europe as a place for foreign investors to base their businesses. So the domestic landscape and the international landscape, I think, are always slightly different, but actually foreign investors still see the UK as a really important place to put their investment across Europe.
And what have you found in terms of the key insights from the survey? Has anything changed? Are there new sort of considerations that need to be sort of, you know, accounted for example, government policy? What shifted? You know, you would think with the things that have happened in the world, and with Brexit as well in the last couple of years, we'd be treating a really, really different picture in terms of attractiveness. But is everything looking pretty much the same?
I think there's probably a sort of short term and a kind of medium to long term issue that we've seen. So I think if you compare the top three in Europe, so France, Germany and the UK, France had a much better year in 2021. It really rebounded. Projects grew by about 20%, and France very much the leader across Europe in terms of attracting inward investment. UK in second. Actually, Germany had a really tough year last year. Investment was actually down in Germany by about 10%. And I think a bit of that reflects the kind of the relative strengths of those economies and their experience through COVID. So the French economy has actually proved a little bit more robust and rebounded a little bit more quickly off the back of COVID than either the UK or the German economies. And perhaps it's a little bit more balanced. So UK very service orientated, very impacted by global travel bans, or Germany very manufacturing orientated. And so really caught up in the global disruption we've seen to automotive supply chains.
Yeah.
So that's, I think, you know, those types of pressures we'd expect to ease as the supply chain blockages and international travel come back. But I think longer term, what we did see across Europe was manufacturing investment had recovered far more quickly than investment in services. And we thought that was quite interesting because we may be beginning to see a bit of a trend. It's where that whole story about rebuilding supply chains, more resilient supply chains, more localized supply chains might be playing out in a, in a sort of a surge of reinvestment in European manufacturing capability. And actually, the UK lags a little bit there, and Brexit is an element of why perhaps the UK is not as attractive as it would be. And then when it comes to services investment, this shift to hybrid working, the use of online technology may mean that if you're a service business, digital business, you don't need the physical presence that perhaps you needed in the past. So that was an interesting trend that we'll keep a close eye on over the next couple of years.
Do you think that there seems to be sort of a balance in the forecast that Alpesh has been talking about, which is how the next year to 18 months or so is going to feel for people, households in this country, and some of the numbers that might sort of float in the sort of more macroeconomic picture in the business picture, which is going to be a challenge for the government to sort of tell a story about if it's a recession in all but name, because it feels that way on a day-to-day basis. Do you think that kind of weaker economic outlook will damage the UK's attractiveness to investors, or do you think what we'll be able to sell through?
So, I mean, you made an important point, and as did Alpesh, that this is very much a kind of global story. So the forces that are buffeting the UK economy in supply chains and energy prices, and indeed around tight labour markets, that's a global story. It's not just a UK story. Those apply elsewhere. So I think, you know, we should see the UK's performance in that global context. I think there are elements of the current environment that make the UK in certain sectors less attractive. So, you know, automotive manufacturing so tied into European supply chains and manufacturing more generally, I think that will be a challenge. But areas where the UK has kind of outright competitive advantage, whether that's financial services, whether it's digital, whether it's some elements of high value manufacturing, then it will continue to be an attractive place to invest. I think the key thing is the model where you set up shop in the UK to serve a European market, the kind of, if you like, the classic Japanese investment model, that is clearly less challenge or less attractive in a post-Brexit world. But the UK remains a leader in digital, a European leader in digital. And so, you know, if you're a big US tech company, the UK is going to be your first port of call.
Yeah, fascinating. Thanks so much, Peter. If you have questions for Peter, please do let us know. I'm going to come now to Chan in the glorious Midlands. Lovely to see you. Good morning, Chan. Thank you for being here. Chan Khatri, you're the Chief Executive for EMH Group. And just in case people don't know about your business, what do you do? How do you operate? How long have you been around? Just give us a sense of what you do on a day-to-day basis.
Okay, so EMH, East Midlands Housing, has been around since 1946. We provide affordable housing for people for whom the marketplace cannot provide the housing solutions. So we've got 21,000 homes across the East Midlands and a revenue turnover of 130 million. Most of our housing is provided for rent, although we also provide, develop and manage and maintain shared ownership housing. For many people, that's about the only way they can get onto the ladder, where they buy a certain share of home. And as their circumstances improve, they can staircase upwards. And we also have an adult social care business where we provide services for people with learning difficulties and also adult social care services for people in extra care schemes. These are schemes where people can live independently, but also ask for care and support as their circumstances require it.
So, Chan, you are working with a lot of people who fit the definition of, the people least able to cope, the households with who are going to feel the cost of living squeeze most keenly. Just give us a sense of what you're seeing already from the clients and beneficiaries that you work with in terms of the affordability of life at the moment. How is that playing back into your business already?
Well, as you say, Liz, we work with some of the most disadvantaged people in society whose average or median incomes will be lower than the national median incomes. And they don't have the wherewithal to cope with shocks in terms of inflation and rising costs. So we are seeing a lot of people relying on food banks. A lot of our people who live in our tenancies are not necessarily in full-time employment. And if they are, usually, or in many cases, these are insecure forms of employment, perhaps 0 hours contracts. There's a great deal of uncertainty already many of these people. Now with food and fuel prices going up and energy prices going up, they are beginning to feel the pinch. We know this because a lot more of our residents are relying on food banks, in fact, to the point where the food banks are having to restrict the amount that they can give to those people in need. So they're going through a particularly difficult time. We're trying our very best to support them. We have increased our financial inclusion resources. So these are people who are working with our communities to see how we can maximise their debt, manage their debt, maximise their incomes and any benefits that they may be entitled to. And, you know, we're not in the we're in the business of housing people. We're not in the business of evicting people. So we work really hard with them to ensure they don't get into rent arrears. But it is becoming extremely difficult. I know a lot of them are basically, you know, choosing whether to eat or heat. They're choosing whether to pay, you know, their utility bill or indeed their rent. And these are difficult choices to make in the way that they've never had to make for a long, long time. So we are seeing a lot of people in a difficult situation. Our rent arrears are gradually creeping up. And, you know, this, along with the fact that we're actually struggling to recruit labour, because we do have 1,200 employees in the organisation, and we're really struggling to recruit. We've got a higher turnover than we've ever had. And if we can't get the frontline maintenance workers or frontline care workers, we can't provide those services. And that makes it even worse for those people who are already going through a difficult time. I think just to add to that, that traditionally, you know, local authorities would have been in a position to provide greater support, particularly for those, you know, with mental health issues. Of course, over the last decade and longer, they've had to endure cuts. So they're in much less of a position to provide the kind of support they would have done. So we do end up picking up some of those cases as well. So, yeah, it's not a particularly easy time at the moment for our residents.
Chan, if we take a couple of those pressures, on the one hand, the people who for whom you are their landlord, effectively, they pay your rent, that is a massive chunk of your revenue and they're struggling to meet those bills. And then on the other hand, after that, your ability as a business to find the people you need to deliver the services you provide. Let's take those two in turn. On the first point, do you think that the package of measures that the government has already announced is sufficient to help you with the people being able to afford to pay the rent, and or are there other things that you as a business would like to see happening to sort of alleviate that pressure?
Yeah, I mean, some of the measures clearly will be of help, particularly in terms of, you know, grants to help with their energy costs and so on and so forth. But clearly it's not enough. You know, I think, you know, the resilience of our residents to cope with some of the shocks will be alleviated by those measures. But I think one of the things government could do is to restore the £20 a week universal credit uplift that they introduced during the pandemic and then they removed. You know, that makes a lot of difference to our residents. Benefits generally haven't gone up by more than, well, they went up by 3.1% this April, in line with the September inflation last year. So that clearly represents a fall in real incomes. So I think wherever possible, the government should look to maintain and universal credit support beyond the level they have at the moment, but also look at increasing benefits to keep pace with inflation.
And on the labour shortages point, we've talked about this a lot at the CBI, and I'm going to come back to Alpesh in a second because some recommendations about how to alleviate some of these labour shortages are in the forecast. What would you like to see happening as a business to help you fill those critical gaps? As you say, it's frontline maintenance, which really matters when you're, you know, you've got a leaking pipe or something that needs fixing, and you're struggling to get the people who have the skills and the availability and want to do that work. How can you, in a sort of sharp end challenge like that, you know, the pipe is leaking, I need someone now. What could be done differently to help take the pressure off?
I mean, they're clearly... some long-term solutions to this we need to start thinking about. For instance, in terms of the care, this part of our business, the government promised the Green Paper, which is going to look at workforce planning for the care sector. I think the other thing they can do, and that's something that's been long overdue, they need to really bring that forward. Because in terms of our care business, we've got turnover of 25%. We're just not able to fill those posts. And that means people in serious need of care and support are not receiving that service that they desperately need. So there is a real urgent issue here. And I think the promised Green Paper on care and support, which was going to look at both the funding, the long-term vision for the care sector, and indeed workforce planning, needs to be really brought forward. Beyond that, of course, you know, we need to ensure that where possible, the ability for where we cannot get labour in this country, the ability for people from abroad to come along to meet our needs is made a lot more easier than it is at the moment. So I think that's got to be part of the answer. But also the pay levels in the care sector are particularly low at the moment. And that's mainly due to the fact that the commissioning bodies who provide those services, mainly adult social care departments and local authorities, simply haven't got the money to keep pace with the costs of providing those services. And the biggest cost, of course, is the cost of labour. So we're not able to attract people into the sector because the pay levels are relatively lower than others.
It's fascinating listening to Chan talk about the specific, very precise things that would help his business and the clients that use it right now. Alpesh, in your forecast, there is a package of measures that you recommend or call for that would, some of which would have a much more near-term impact to alleviate some of the things that Chan is talking about. Just talk us through, you know, when we've talked about labour shortages and skills planning and things, very often we end up looking at sort of not even a decade away, you know, it's a long time. But there are some things that could or should arguably be happening now, aren't there?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, I'm sure, you know, a lot of what Chan has just said will be resonating with businesses, you know, up and down the country. You know, when we talk to businesses, the tightness in the labour market and just the implications that's having for sort of recruitment and retention, and you know, sort of filling those very sort of mission critical roles is quite profound. So I think, look, I mean, it's quite telling that we haven't actually, you know, put together a new shortage occupations list for about 3 years, ever since sort of reforms to the UK's immigration regime were sort of put into force. So it's time to really take a granular look at that and think about, you know, where are the roles that we need to plug the gaps most? Because obviously the labour market has evolved a fair bit over the last few years. And adding sectors that are facing very obvious skill shortages. You know, aviation is a very good example where you had a lot of workers actually leave the sector during the pandemic, just because obviously they were more likely to be put on furlough. It was a sector that was most affected by sort of travel restrictions. And so as a result, now that the sector is sort of coming back to life, they're really struggling to find the people that they need. And you know, that plays into a lot of the stories that we're hearing at the moment about sort of flights being cancelled and sort of issues at airports. Hospitality is another very good example, which is sort of facing similar issues. A lot of workers sort of left the industry during the pandemic. They've got jobs elsewhere, they've retrained. So now really the sector is facing an acute shortage of skills. So sort of, you know, revisiting the shortage occupations list and thinking about how it is fit for purpose for where we are at the moment in the economy is actually quite important. And then sort of reforms to the apprenticeship levy are also quite a key one. You know, that there needs to be a lot more flexibility in that, you know, just to allow the employers in the country to sort of use their funds as they need to, skills wise, you know, to tackle the labour shortages that they're facing in their immediate business. That's obviously sort of just two measures, but two measures that could really make a big difference in the near term, particularly as I say that we seem to be in that state of persistent tightness in the labour market. And while we expect some of that to ease going forward, we do expect a bit of a loosening in the labour market as the economy weakens. Mm. Actually, it still remains relatively tight. You know, by the end of our forecast, the unemployment rate is only just a little bit above 4%, which is still very close to historic lows. So this doesn't seem to be a problem that's going away anytime soon. So it's clear that more immediate action is needed.
Alpesh, just briefly before I come to Peter, there's been a great question asked about investment. If the shortage occupations list was to be reviewed, as you suggest, and let's say a new type of role or sector was added to that list, what does that practically do? What does being on that list unlock in terms of labour shortages? What happens?
Well, I suppose in summary, at a very high level, what it does is that it sort of makes the immigration rules around that particular occupation just a bit looser. So if you do have an occupation on that list, what it means is that sort of priority will be given to economic migrants who have qualifications which kind of meet that role, or sort of who are moving here to sort of for that sort of job. It makes sort of recruiting from abroad a bit easier for businesses as well. So it just means that we're able to get the people that we need for the roles that we need more seamlessly, which is really what you want at the moment, which is really what you need in a labour market that's so tight.
Yeah, fascinating. Thanks ever so much. And Peter, I want to put to you a question that's been asked by Jack Semple, who is watching today. Given the government's new policy imperative to reverse the historic decline in UK manufacturing and what you were talking about earlier about manufacturing investment having reduced due to Brexit, what can or should the government do? Are they doing enough? Should they be doing something differently to ensure that manufacturing recovers to where we want it to be?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very good question. And I think we probably almost need to think around a kind of a industrial strategy, dare I say it, that really thinks, OK, well, there are some real challenges around lack of access to the single market, but we still have some areas of competitive strength. And the question is really around scaling up those areas and focusing on those areas, perhaps rather than trying to, you know, capture parts of the manufacturing landscape that have gone. I think one area where we at EY do see, or our survey suggests there may be an opportunity, is around the whole kind of green agenda or clean tech agenda. So we call it clean tech in our survey, but you can call it the green industrial revolution. There is clearly lots of investment is going to be going into renewable technology, is going to be going into electric vehicles, is going to be going into heat pumps and so on. And I think there's a real opportunity here, given some of perhaps the natural advantages the UK has in terms of its you know, the renewable opportunity around offshore wind and hydrogen and CCUS and so on, that you really try and focus on ensuring that UK is not just deploying all these technologies that perhaps arguably we have done so far with offshore wind. And if you look at the new nuclear program, a lot of that is reliant on technology from France or from China. But we really look to develop and build those technologies as well as just deploying them. And I think that would be an area where I think the government really needs to think about focus support to try and establish critical mass. So you get first mover advantage in those areas, you build a globally competitive sector, and that should hopefully kickstart or rebuild some of that manufacturing capability, particularly in the Northwest, East and in the West Mids. So I think that would be one opportunity I do see.
It's interesting, Peter, that you mention offshore wind farms, because Alpesh, offshore wind farms is specifically called out right at the very top of your recommendations of what could be done this summer. Why is that? Why is that such a huge opportunity? Is it just totemic, or is it, you know, the quantum of it sufficient to make a difference?
No, I think it's both actually. I think, you know, there is, you're sort of killing two birds with one stone. So I think what we've called for is cutting approval times for new offshore wind farms from 4 years to 1 year. You know, the fact that it takes 4 years just to approve the building of a new wind farm is, you know, it is a huge sort of lag when we think about the investment issue that we're facing. If you sort of reduce the approval time, that's in and of itself is an automatic boost to business investment. And as I say, you know, the UK does have a big structural investment problem compared to other G7 countries, but obviously is also a key, you know, it is a key step forward in our journey towards net zero and decarbonisation. So it's sort of taking what is a long-standing economic challenge, but also sort of tailoring it a bit more to sort of these new challenges that we're facing further ahead when we think about the need to cut carbon emissions, to, you know, to secure our energy supply. And, you know, that also comes back to what we're seeing on the global front. We're very exposed to the volatility in global energy supply and global energy prices. And actually getting to a place where we have a more secure domestic energy supply will help to mitigate some of that. So you're sort of hitting lots of targets at once with just that sort of one measure, if you like, which is why it features so highly in our sort of package of measures that are needed to boost confidence in the economy.
I mentioned this slightly trepidatiously, Alpesh, but the introduction to the forecast is a sort of a flag, a warning, if you like, that there's a danger that the economy might play second fiddle to politics. You know, we're in the sort of we're not quite the wind down the period to recess, but there's not much time between now and the recess over the summer. Just in our last few minutes, you're calling for the government to resolve the Northern Ireland Protocol. I mean, if only it was that easy. What are the things that threaten, I suppose, to detract from practical actions that could be taken to not just people like Chan and the people who use the services that the MH Group provides, but to everybody across the economy? What are the things that threaten to derail the conversation?
Well, I think you've pretty much just said it. It's the threat that we see, what we've seen over the last few weeks, which is politics taking center stage at the expense of the economics. I mean, I said at the start of this webinar that, you know, we have called very explicitly for you know, focus to shift away around sort of Operation Save Big Dog and actually start thinking about the big economic challenges that we're facing, both in the near term with the cost of living crisis, but over the longer term, you know, a lot of the longer term structural issues that the UK is facing haven't gone away. And there is a risk that actually what we've seen in the last few weeks does persist. So, you know, certainly coming back to sort of the Northern Ireland Protocol impasse, you know, unilateral action on the part of the UK is not helpful, and neither is the relative inflexibility on the EU side. And, you know, this is coming at a time when businesses are already having to deal with a lot in terms of cost pressures, in terms of labor shortages, and now sort of facing a weaker demand environment as well. You know, we already have a structural exports underperformance. You know, our forecast, that's a very key message coming across from our forecast. And this, the last thing we need is sort of more frictions in trade with our biggest trading partner, the EU. So really we need both sides to really, you know, have the economy at the forefront of their minds and at the forefront of their sort of objectives, the economy, growth, thinking, you know, smoothing over the challenges we've got in the near term. And that's why it's really important for both sides to get on with the job of finding a negotiated outcome and come back to the table in the spirit of sort of compromise and sort of a constructive mindset. And you know, you're right, there's not a lot of time before recess. There's only a very small window. So it, you know, now's the time for action, really. You know, that's not something we can stress enough.
Just briefly, in our last couple of minutes, Chan, I'd love to come back to you and ask two asks. I can't guarantee that Rishi Sunak is watching or listening, but what would be the things that would make the biggest difference to your ability as a business to mitigate some of the challenges that are happening right now?
Yeah, interesting question, Liz. I mean, the first thing to say is that our rents are highly regulated rents, and the current rent settlement comes to an end in 2025. The government will start to consult on the future rent settlement, and goes without saying that the current indexed policy that we have, where our rents go up by CPI plus 1%, is highly essential, not just to maintain our existing services, but to develop new homes. And we developed 550 new homes with a lower income cap. We're likely to produce much less, lower number than that. But the biggest challenge we've got, and others have made reference to it, is that we've got to retrofit and decarbonize our existing homes. So, you know, this does require a fair bit of investment. First target we have is to bring all of our homes up to EPC level C by 2030. And then by 2050, we need to, you know, introduce clean heat, move away from fossil fuels and gas boilers. And we've already started that process with, you know, air source heat pumps and external wall insulations and so on. All of this is really good in terms of addressing fuel poverty, but it's also good from an environment point of view. So really, I would suggest that certainty on future rent policy, and actually looking at the social housing decarbonisation fund, which really helps us to build this program to the level we need to and do it a lot quicker.
Yeah, fascinating. Well, thank you very much to all of our esteemed panelists for joining us today. It's been a fascinating and I think important conversation. You can see the detail in Alpesh's forecast on the CBI website. I'm sure that if you were to go to the EY website, you'd be able to find the findings of the UK Attractiveness Survey 2 from Peter and the team at EY. As I always say, before you go dive back into your emails, please do go and put the kettle on and look at the sunshine. And thank you very much to Chan and to Peter and to Alpesh for joining us today, and have a great rest of the day. All the best. Bye-bye.